Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Skylar Wilson. Skylar Wilson is a 33-year-old wilderness and meditation guide who founded Wild Awakenings and leads intercultural ceremonies. For more information and to get involved, visit orderofthesacredearth.org. So what I really want to talk about is a book that you recently put out with Matthew Fox and Jennifer Barrett Listug. And that is Order of the Sacred Earth, an intergenerational vision of love and action. So before we talk about the book itself, can you talk about how the book came about?
Sure, yeah. And before I do that, I just want to say that, Derek, it's great to be with you, and I really appreciate all of the work that you've done for so many years. And I know I mentioned this once before to you, but when I was taking my first environmental studies class, freshman year of college, I read your book, Language Older Than Words, and was inspired by it. And so it was part of my setting out on this course. And it's been almost 20 years since then. So it's an honor to be with you and to be learning with you and on this journey. So thanks for that. And so Order of the Sacred Earth, it came to both Matthew and I in the same week via dreams. He had a dream that was, you know, start in order. He explains it is that he was getting a directive from the universe or from the earth and just to do it and to start an order that's not a religious order. Like so many of the past via Buddhism, Christianity, Judaism, but something new, something that was directed, directly connected to the earth herself. And my dream was a little bit different, but I was in, I actually had two dreams that I've sometimes put together in my mind. But one was meditating with a group of, there's four other people, and we were hovering above San Francisco at sunrise. And in the second dream, I mean, that was a powerful image of coming together and being accessing some kind of power and connection. The second dream was we were training on Muir Beach near San Francisco and where I was living at the time. And we were training to, it was like a re-education in how to be connected to the earth as a living, intelligent being. And so we were training to do that. And so we were around a fire and we were, looking into each other's eyes. And we were, basically cutting through all of the shit, so to speak, that keeps us from remembering our connection and feeling it. So, yeah, both dreams were very much about training and learning from the earth as a community. So when Matt reached out and told me about his dream, I told him about mine, and it was enough to get us started on this, starting writing the book, and it all unfolded from there.
So let's define some terms here. What is, and we should just go ahead and be open about the technological fiasco we had before, that we did this interview a couple months ago and I screwed up and the recording did not work. And so as well as just talking, there's also some snippets that I remember before that were very powerful. And so as well as just having an organic conversation, I'm also going to be reaching back and going, but wait a second, I think we talked about this and it was pretty interesting. Anyway, I just wanted to bring people up to that. So anyway, one of the things I remember was that there was we defined some terms. And can you define what an order is?
So Matthew would probably describe it a little bit differently, more historically than I will. But what there's a couple different meanings. One is the orders, like the orders of the past. It's a collective. An organizational model, so to speak, which is about coming together, a small group or a smaller, less less religious or organized group coming together when there's something out of balance and coming together to create a more in tune way of being with whatever life is asking of the moment. And so we've seen that throughout history. And my history of orders isn't as good as his, so I won't even go into it to that. But most people are probably familiar with that term. The second is bringing order to a time of unraveling and chaos, like what we're in, seeing the climate crisis, and also realizing, I guess, a third is that there is natural intelligence. There is order that is beyond us, an intelligence beyond us that created us, and we call that Earth in this context, but it's also a great mystery to us and in the field of spirituality as well. I mean, the mystics have been pondering what the meaning of life is and what our purpose is. And so we kind of carry on all of those inquiries in calling it an order.
And in the book and also on the website, orderthesacredearth.org, you are very clear about making a distinction between spiritual and religious. It says, what is the order of the sacred earth? We are not religious because it will not be beholden to any religious headquarters, only one religious tradition. And the next paragraph, you say, many of us are identifying ourselves at this time in history as spiritual but not religious. And mm-hmm. I think that will probably resonate with I think there are probably a lot of people who would connect to that feeling. Can you talk a little bit about why that might be the case? What does it mean? Like when you
so,
or anybody
yeah.
else associated with this book says we are many of us are identifying ourselves at this time in history as spiritual but not religious. What do you mean by that?
Thank you. And it's important to unpack these terms because there's so much confusion and different meanings for these words that I appreciate starting there. And for me, and I think many that I've heard from in this movement of currently it's about 2,000 people have taken the vow or the initiative, and we can talk about that later, what that is. But what many of them are saying or feeling drawn to is that religion doesn't really, we as humans are drawn in a sacred context, but not necessarily through any of the channels that have been there as the way of doing that traditionally or in the past. And so spirituality for me, speaks to our fundamental connection to what is to life, that inquiry at least. And in New Age spirituality, that's often been noted to mean your personal practices or your personal ways to, you know, personal growth or personal ways that you make yourself better or you deal with your own traumas and tribulations of life and find comfort in something larger, I suppose. For me, though, it's synonymous with the earth. It's connecting directly to the earth. And as Rabbi Heschel says, all religion and all spirituality can be boiled down to one word, which is remembrance. And so I know that I forget all the time who I am and what I'm for, what I'm doing. And it's, I make a space in my day, in my life, to come back to some kind of core experience, core remembering of who I am and what I'm part of.
I don't want to get too linguistic.
So I don't know.
I'm sorry.
No,
go ahead. Go ahead, please.
No, I was going to say I don't know if that answers your question. It's I find it to be a very hard one to answer, but it's clear that we want to make a distinction between we don't want anyone to feel left out of this this movement who still feels very connected with a religion, traditions of the past. I don't think that that's necessary, but we also want to make a clear distinction going forward that this is something emergent and something new that is also similar in some ways to many things that have happened before. But it's a new time in history right now where we are in uncharted territory as far as what's happening on the planet and the human levels of destruction. So that's kind of the angle that we're coming at it.
That's great. Thank you for that. And I was going to say that I don't want to get too linguistically cute, but I love what you said about remember, and I love thinking about remembering not merely as bringing something up in our memory, but also becoming a member once again, remembering. And again, that's a bit linguistically cute, but I do like it.
I do too.
And I guess where I would be going with that is you have stressed through this conversation so far, and the book stresses that the Earth is intelligent and alive. And can you talk about we've talked about the word order. Can you talk about the word sacred? And can you also talk about the implications of perceiving yourself as a living member of a living planet, as opposed to a sentient being on a as opposed to life happening on a dead rock? Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
I do. Yes. So I think that many of the reasons that we're in the position that we're in, whether you believe that the world, the Earth is a conscious, intelligent being or not, I think it's even easier to gather around the idea that our lack of appreciation of the planet, our lack of feeling it as something sacred, something that is worthy of our utmost love and concern, or that is our home, our mother. There's many analogies and archetypes that have been used, but Thomas Berry was a geologian, cultural historian who we reference in the book quite a bit, and he's inspired Matthew Fox's work a lot and myself as well. And he talks about how we're not going to even begin to unravel the our gap with presence to the planet unless we start to uncover what the sacred is for us. And so and realizing that the whole universe is this celebration from its initial unfolding until now, and that's a celebration that we're part of. And so having a cosmology, a story, a recognition that there's something larger than ourselves, something that's important, something that is sacred, is at the core of, you know, it's why we named the book Order of the Sacred Earth. And it's I think one of the most important concepts in the book is what does the sacred mean, and why is it important that we get back in touch with that, whether you revere or call it by Mother Mary or Buddha or a cosmic Christ or anything like that. That's up to the individual. I think but if we can come together around something as fundamental and as the idea of the sacred, I think then we're getting into a place where a deeper and deeper place as human beings, and really to save ourselves. It's I believe that the Earth is going to be fine. I mean, many of the plants and animals that are alive right now will die off as a result of what we're doing to the planet. But I ultimately believe the Earth will restore herself. But we humans won't unless we make some big changes, and changes at the core level that I think, unless we engage all of who we are, and the sacred is something that I feel like gets at that, then I don't think we stand a chance.
I think that given that currently we're the agents of the we as a culture are agents of this destruction. My primary loyalty runs to those non-humans who are currently being wiped out through our actions. So I think one of the things I've always been grateful to Matthew Fox for has been that he introduced me to Meister Eckhart. And there's a delightful phrase that Matthew Fox introduced me to of Meister Eckhart's, which is, if the only prayer you say in your life is thank you, that would be sufficient. And so can you talk a little bit about gratitude and its relationship to this new / old order that you're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, I love that quote by him. And Matthew also introduced me to Meister Eckhart as well. My favorite quote by Meister Eckhart is, "The soul grows through subtraction." I'll get to your question in a second, but I feel that's my favorite quote by him because it's really helped me to embrace death and respect it as both large and small deaths in my life, but also the death of so many other beings on the planet right now, is that that it gives me some idea of what destruction might be happening, that it might be that our cultural, our human soul, or as a collective might be needing to grow right now. This kind of ties into your question. Thank you, I feel like, is the start of that opening. By thanking death, by thanking life, by thanking ourselves for the ways that we show up, by thanking the great mystery, by thanking the earth, it's a start. It's an opening to being in conversation with life, and in a way that if we're not grateful, if we're not acknowledging the other, then we're not even present to the other. We're not present to anything. And so I think that's why Meister Eckhart's prayer, or his words about thank you being enough, I think that's where it all starts.
So I was hoping to introduce this a little bit later in the conversation, but it does seem appropriate to start this now. Part of the, you mentioned earlier something called the vow, and you said there are a couple thousand people who had taken the vow. What do you mean?
Mm-hmm. So vows have been used as a technology, so to speak, or as an organizing principle for people for a long time. We're most familiar with wedding or marriage vows, for instance. And in our case, the vow is just simply one vow, is to be the best lover and defender of the earth that we can be. And we add in that part that we can be, because we don't feel it's for anybody else to judge what that looks like, that we all have different jobs to do in this great time of unraveling, and that it's not about holding up some sort of external standard, but it's about each of us coming into a deep conversation with ourselves about what is most important. And in order to focus our attention and energy, and we've heard from many people who have taken the vow, especially some of the younger people, that with social media and with so many things pulling at our attention, that it's important to have something as an anchor, something like a vow that we can come back to, similar to a mantra or to some core principle that we remember again and again. And so that's what we've named as the centering vow for this order. And we also expect and hope that everybody will interpret that differently. And yet with the same sort of vigor of coming at it from a place of not wanting nothing less than complete transformation for ourselves and for the planet, because we realize that there's so many things that have to change about the way that we see ourselves and the way that we participate with the more than human world that are necessary. And so something like a vow is deeper than just an intellectual commitment. It involves the heart. And that's something that we feel is important. It's something that also involves community. And we've had vow taking rituals that have been very powerful, where we've come together in some simple way and had an opportunity for people to come into the center of the circle and state their vow or something like it. And there's been a lot of other, we've heard from others who've organized similar things. And it's just, it's a way for humans to come together and go deep and make a personal commitment, but a community or a collective organizing principle as well.
And I'm thinking about what you just said about vows being like a wedding vow, that you are, you know, vowing to another person. That's it's by definition relational. But then I was thinking, you know, you think about, you know, you see an old Western movie or something where somebody shoots somebody's father, and then the child vows to avenge the parent's death. And I was thinking, well, maybe it's not relational, but then I realized it actually is, because it's still, you're vowing to avenge because of your relationship with your parent. And so a vow, and maybe I'm just being very simplistic here, but so is a vow a promise made to another? Is that what a vow is? A vow is a promise made to yourself and to another.
I think so. I think it's a vow to yourself and to another. And there's something about it being heard or recognized that keeps it honest. That makes it, there's a reason some people choose to get married in private, but I guess you're not in private because you're with your beloved or your partner. So there's something about it being seen and heard, and that amplifying the power of it, the power of that commitment. So I think so. Yeah, I think I was actually, to be fully honest, I was surprised by when we did the first vow ritual, by how powerful it was. I wasn't like so many, I have my doubts every day about what's going to be meaningful and what's going to work. And a lot of the time I'm experimenting and just trying things out. And so, that was an experiment. And my experience was that, I felt it. I felt the vow, like my life felt changed. After that, I was sort of thinking to myself, like, is this going to do anything? I've already been working on, behalf of the environment for many years on behalf of the earth and environmental activism and, taking groups out into the wilderness, et cetera. And, I didn't know if I needed to take a vow. I didn't really know if I should hold stock in it, but I did feel personally changed, in some really simple ways, but also some long lasting ways. But, and I also feel like it's something I need to, I keep coming back to. For a little while, I was wearing it's similar in the Buddhist tradition of wearing a red piece of yarn around your wrist to remember your commitment to Dharma, to community. I wore something like that, and it was helpful to just have a tangible way that I was remembering it. Or when I got married last year to my wife, we decided to have rings like so many do. And so the ring is an anchoring in that vow. So there's ways, different ways that we remember the vows that we've taken, but it's a touch point more than anything for me, where when I'm fighting with my wife about one thing or another, it's a way of like coming back and being like, oh yeah, this is why we're together. This is why we decided to make this commitment.
So what is the order? Are the vows, do the vows that people take, what's the process if somebody is interested in, well, let's back up. Can you say again, what is the order? What is the actual order of the sacred earth? What are you hoping for from this process? And what sort of community are you hoping to build? Is it a community?
Mm-hmm. It is a community. There's about 2,000 people who have taken the vow and who are active in some way with what we're doing. We hold monthly council meetings, and you can find out about those on our website by signing up for our newsletter. But we do very little general organization, and we leave it up to local chapters or pods to organize themselves, because we believe each bioregion has its own strengths and challenges, and each person can ultimately decide how they want to be supported by the order. But ultimately, what we're trying to do is to create, is to bring together the network that's already forming, the millions of people that have already woken up from out of the culturally destructive Western paradigm, and who want to make their life something different. And we realize that there's so many different layers of integration that have to be brought into that process. It's not like we can just identify what's wrong and change it from that place. So it's an emergent inquiry. It's a emergent community where we're taking note of the way that ecological adaptation and evolution takes place, and trying to create some sense of order, some sense of connection, of ways people can connect and inspire one another and amplify each other's work. But there's, like I was saying, there's so many different networks that are engaged in this kind of work. Our hope is just to be yet another channel where people can find out about what's going on in their areas. They can connect to local community. They can connect to a fairly vast network that's growing of people who are really dedicated to this work, and they can find community at a time where so much is unraveling and needing to be transmuted, and change is inevitable, and so we're holding space. It's a concept a term that I use a lot, holding space. It's kind of deep listening together to what's emerging, what's happening, what needs to change, and how do we do this while at the same time not really having the answers, but knowing that the need is huge.
So is the vow that people take when they join this order, is it simply I promise to be the best lover and defender of the earth that I can be, or is there more to the vow that they actually say?
It's ultimately up to each person. We don't really give, in the book, we outline some of the basics, for why people take vows and how a vow can, I guess I should also say that we invited a lot of different, a diverse range of people to contribute to the book. So it's the first chapter is longer essays by Matthew Fox and Jennifer Barrett and I. And then the second half is these reflections by many of the members of our larger community. And so we invited that diversity because we feel that there's so many different ways to go about this. We don't want to limit that creativity from happening. So, you know, when I speak to people about this, when they ask that question, I put the question back on them of what do you feel is going to support you in becoming your best ecological self, your most open vessel for relating with the many more than human forms that constellates our larger community. What's at the heart of your work, of who you are? Those are some of the ways that I think we can tune in and meditate on what it really means to be an individual and also part of a community. And so does that answer your question?
Yeah, and it, I think, leads to, I think, maybe the most important question of our time, and maybe the most important question of the last few thousand years, which is, how do you move toward an earth-based religion or earth-based spirituality? And I realize those are two different things, but they don't need to be. How does one begin? How does one do the work of, what's the right verb? Not manufacturing, living one's way into, maybe, is the best. How does one begin the work of living one's way into an earth-based religion, and how does one, or spirituality, and how does one collectively, how do we collectively transform from a religion that is not particularly earth-based and is fact clearly earth-destroying? How do we convert that into an earth-based and earth, one that recognizes, as it says in the book, the sacredness of the earth? How does that happen?
We have yet to see it. You know, we can look back at, I mean, that's such a good question because, you know, if I knew, then we would, you know, we wouldn't be where we are today. So, you know, I think that it's hubristic to think that it's an easy answer. I like so many others, I want an easy answer to this. I want to just believe that there's a way to wake up and just change. But it's clear to me that it's going to take much more than that to mobilize enough humans to make any kind of real big significant change. And so that's where I feel spirituality and the sacred come in, because it's recognizing that I and that we in many ways have very little power over this you know, this big steering, this big ship of humanity in a different direction, and yet we all, like, all we can each do is our best to try. And so it's very humbling, I think. For me, the doorway into it has been both wonder and grief, the two doorways. It's like Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese monk, you know, likens it to going, like, you wouldn't send somebody into surgery who's just barely surviving. The same thing is true with grief. You want to build up the immune system first, build oneself up with love and with joy and with gratitude for being alive and feeling how good it is to still be alive in this moment, and then go into grief from that place. And so many of the rituals that I've guided and been a part of happen in that way. We connect together to gratitude and to community and to all the things that nourish us, and then go in together to grieve all of the imbalances and all the ways that we that we're afraid, and all the ways that we feel powerless in this situation. And I think that's a really important doorway into gaining more insight into this process.
So can you talk a little bit more about the The work that you do with people, the spiritual work you do with people in the wild.
Well, that's my favorite. It's when I feel the most alive is when I'm doing that work. And partly that comes from my own journey, wholly comes from my own journey. But when I was 13, my parents got a divorce, and it was a horrible divorce. They wouldn't even talk to each other, and I was kind of in the middle of that. And I knew at that point I had some intuition. I asked my mom. I said, "Can I go away for the summer?" And she connected me with a friend, an old friend of hers who was running canoe trips up in Ontario. And I spent the summer canoeing 700 miles in the wilderness of Ontario with this small group. And I had some amazing experiences, and I also had some space to break down. And so I had kind of a vision quest, or a without knowing it at the time, it set the stage for what my work was going to be, which is I take groups out into the wilderness, and we set up a base camp, and we start to tune in to the more than human world around us. And I found that the wilderness has such a great effect on the nervous system and provides so many insights for ways that our lives are out of balance and in our day-to-day culture. And then people go out and choose a spot. And this is, I'm modeling it after many teachers. The School of Lost Borders is one, Bill Plotkin's work, and Ennis Valley Institute, and also really, it's been about since the 70s, there's been this effort to create a not an a, like appropriation appropriating any other culture's rites of passage or traditions, but coming up with one for the postmodern mind, for the Western culture. And so just hold that aspect of it fairly organically, of each trip is different, but have people go out and spend up to 4 days alone in nature and without food if they choose to do that. And the insights and healing that I've seen have been profound. And then come back and integrate that and come up with clear steps for how to make each person's life what they want it to be. So core commitments, core beliefs, examining everything about what makes us human. And recently I've also been working with a wilderness therapy program. And so working with teenagers that are struggling with depression, anxiety, attempts at committing suicide, drugs, everything, and working with them in the wilderness, in an even more structured and regimented way with therapists and stuff to really help them unravel the patterns that are causing the suffering, to see what they have a choice to change and what they just have to accept, and trying to help them with gaining some of the insight and wisdom to know the difference between those two things.
So thank you for that. That's all really brilliant. And can you get specific about what's the difference, or what you perceive as the difference, between going through that process surrounded by ponderosa pine, or it or redwoods, or whomever, or oaks, and doing that, sitting across from somebody, in two comfy chairs?
Yes. So from what I've seen and heard from others and experienced in myself, I've also gained a lot from therapy in a comfortable chair. Probably I would say more, I think more so because I've had these experiences in the wilderness, and it's part of the process of integrating those experiences. as I have felt oftentimes that I've wanted to just be out in the wilderness, and I've had a really hard time living in this society. But I find that the earth speaks to us when we make the space to hear those ponderosa pines, or to connect with the oaks, to have a conversation with the trees, with the stars, with the bugs. And so a big part of my work, and a big part of the work that the Order of the Sacred Earth is trying to create space for, is in recognizing our anthropocentrism. Like, when we're just speaking with humans, when we're just looking at ourselves as separate. And so there's some very deep things that we just cannot heal, places of separation and suffering that we can't heal just speaking to another human about. We have to open up the conversation to the planet to do that. And so, and not just the planet as an idea, but in a direct way, that there's it's incredible. I can't even describe it. It's an incredible experience that's beyond words, when you can actually have a conversation with a hummingbird, or and you open to that, and you listen, and you realize that that what's going on inside of me is fundamentally the earth too, is the earth and is the cosmos. And that when I can experience everything inside of me as that, it really puts it in a different context that is much easier for me to be with than if I feel like I'm a cut off individual and I'm looking to a psychologist or to a pharmaceutical company or to my parents to help me with something that they just can't even come close to helping me with. It's a much deeper issue. Much deeper gap.
Thank you for that. I love that. And I'm going to take a stretch here and see if you can. I'm going to throw out a story and you see if you can make some sense of it, which is a while ago, somebody dumped an old freezer at a friend's house, and I went over with my truck to take the freezer to the freezer to the dump. You know, they had just dumped it there, and I was going to take it to the waste transfer station. And there was some very, very, very old meat in the freezer that the person had dumped. And I popped the top and just staggered. I mean, the smell is just horrific. But the thing that I thought was really cool was that within 10 minutes, there was a vulture circling overhead. And I was... And there had been no vulture on the horizon. You know, I had not seen a vulture in the sky at all. And so I was thinking about how the molecules of rotten meat went into the air and dispersed over, what, I don't know, a half a cubic mile or something? You know, some huge amount of air. So it's just a few molecules. And the molecule has to actually travel up in the air and then travel on the wind. And the vulture has to sense it, figure out where it's coming from, and fly to where I was. Do you see what I'm getting at? And and it just struck me, okay, I'm going to switch subjects now, that I think about bears a lot because I see them every day, and I think about how we will never know what it's like to have the absolutely insatiable hunger, and I'm not speaking metaphorically, but physically, that a bear has in the fall when they're really putting on the fat for the winter. And just how magnificently, you know, we'll never know what it's like to have a sense of smell like a vulture. And how magnificently, whenever I think about how all these different, completely hummingbirds have a metabolic system so fast that they have to fall asleep. I mean, they go into torpor at night so they don't use up energy and die. And just how magnificent all these other beings are, and how completely different they are than we are, and how their experience is so different, yet we still have this communion. Okay, so I've just thrown a whole mess in your lap, and I want you to take this anywhere you want.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Thank you for sharing such a deep experience of like all these different ways that nature shows up and exemplifies ways of tasting and smelling and being connected. You use the word communion with the earth, with the smells of the rotten meat, with the with one's own hunger, with a bear's hunger. To me, it's miraculous how salmon can navigate, you know, back to their river from across the ocean, or a sea turtle finds the nest that it was born on, and you know, or a pelican can find fresh water out in the desert in Africa, where it only rains there once every 10 years. And I mean, how do they know that? My closest sort of experience to that personally is like going without water for a few days in the desert myself. And I got to where I could literally smell water. When I came back, I could smell it. And I had never really, in the shower, I guess I'd smelled water before, or I'd smelled the ocean before, but there was like this sense that opened up for me. And that's the only way that I can make sense of how nature works, is that is through that striving for life, superpowers are created. And, like we come up with solutions, like solutions, the process for finding solutions to big problems, like a bear not being able to find food in the winter and realizing that it can just hibernate and sleep for months on end. It's amazing to me. And it's such a mystery that, that there's so much intelligence, in our own bodies. And, it's just awe-inspiring to me, and also gives me a sense of wanting to lean into those edges within myself, edges of evolution, edges of, you know, Brian Swim, I heard him, the cosmologist, he was a professor of mine years ago in grad school. And he said that if hawks didn't exist, rabbits, would be these fat blobs that could barely move. It's literally the hawks that create, the beauty and the efficiency of the rabbit as it runs. And, there's just example after example of how the natural world creates these relationships that, that create health and well-being at every level, for the predator, for the prey, for the whole ecosystem. And, we're part of that, but we're out of touch with that. And we're, you know, most people in the Western culture are just trying to stay, insulated and comfortable. And that's actually at, you know, it's the opposite of what is going to ultimately, fulfill us or make us happy, or, be in touch with our own metabolism. So anyway, I just rambled too, but I love where you went with that. And I love thinking about this, because it's just such a, it just goes and goes down the rabbit hole, of connection.
Yeah, I'm so glad you said all that. That was honestly my favorite part of the interview so far. I loved what you said. So we're running out of time. And can you tell people how they can learn more about Order of the Sacred Earth? I've got three questions here. How can they learn more about Order of the Sacred Earth, the order? How can they learn more about Order of the Sacred Earth, the book? And how can they learn more about the wilderness work that you specifically are doing?
Great. The Order of the Sacred Earth, people can find information about that at our website, which you've already said, but it's orderofthesacredearth.org. And our email for that is orderofthesacredearth@gmail.com. And My personal work, I do it in partnership with several other organizations, but when I do it just by myself, it's Wild Awakenings. And I no longer have a website for that, but we have a Facebook page, Wild Awakenings, and an email, wildawakenings@gmail. And most of that is word of mouth. So that's how you can find out about our work, and look forward to hearing from you.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. I really enjoyed it, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Skylar Wilson. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.